ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, happy Monday. Selena Green here, bringing you The Country Hour again this week. In a moment, you'll hear that there's been a big change to the Ecky, because now we have the Nicky. What on earth is all that about? We'll stick around because it's all coming out of Beef Week in just a moment. Also, we'll find out why dairy farmers are being warned that price cuts are coming.
There's clearly a disconnect between the global commodity prices, so the prices of your powders, your cheese, your butter, and the farm gate milk price that we're seeing here. And that's really what we're trying to help the farmer understand, is what's actually going on and what will that then mean in terms of 1 June and the prices that they may see.
So we're well into May now. I want to talk about rain as well today. Have you had any? Did you get any over the weekend? What you've had, is it anywhere near enough to get you going? You're still hanging in there, waiting. Talk rain to me today. Let me know. My talkback number is 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. So yes, move over. Ecky. There's a new cattle indicator in town. Meat and Livestock Australia is launching the NICI. It's National Young Cattle Indicator, NYCI. It's on day one of Beef Australia, which is underway in Rockhampton. MLA says the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, or ECI, has been interpreted as a catch-all for the market, despite the indicator shifting in recent years. Well, Market Information Manager with MLA, Steve Bignall, explains why the new NICI was needed.
So the NICI is a new indicator, the National Young Cattle Indicator, and what it is, it's a truly national restocker indicator. At the present we have the ECI, and that looks at processors, feedlots and restockers all in one indicator, and it sort of aggregates them, and so it can be difficult for producers to understand what the price of the category of animal they're selling is actually going for. So this is really a restocker indicator on a national basis that will give those producers selling animals in the restocker market a guide to what they're worth.
And how is it formulated?
What it is including is, it's actually our first indicator that includes both physical sales and online sales. So it will capture physical and online restocker animals over 20 kilos that are vealers, weaners and yearlings of both heifers and steers, and non-station mated animals. So that's what's included in the NICI, and it will be reported in a live weight basis.
So I guess what's important to point out there is it's not the same animals that you might see in the Eastern or Western indicators. It's a different class of animal.
Yes, it's restocker only. So there are some restocker animals in the ECI. We do know that in the ECI, nearly 40% are going to feedlots and about 10% going to processors. So if a producer is selling an animal, a young animal, the ECI may not actually reflect the end market for the animal. This will be restocker specific. And what we hope the producers do is actually understand and take a bit of a nuanced look into the different indicators that we offer, and that they match them up with the category of animals they're selling. So they will look at the NICI for restocker animals, the feeder steer for animals they're selling to a feedlot, and the heavy steer or processor cow for when they're selling finished animals.
Because the ECI has kind of, I guess, become an indicator that a lot of producers use to judge the sentiment of the market, but it's not always a good indicator of that, is it?
The ECI was created at a time when Australia was thinking about having a meat future, so it was in carcass weight. It was at a time when sale yards made up a far bigger proportion of individual transactions. And it also was created at a time when processors were far more active in the sale yard buying young cattle. And as time has changed, we've kept the ECI. It has sort of become the benchmark indicator that MLA offer, but there are questions around it.
How important was it for this to be truly national, to capture the western and central markets as well as the eastern markets for this particular indicator?
So with the ECI, if we're looking at processor animals and feedlots, there is sort of geographic requirements for that. When we're talking about restocker animals, being national is really important, because what we saw in COVID and during the recent drought-breaking rains in 2020-2021 is animals in the restocker market can travel. People were buying animals from the north when the southern Victorian area and New South Wales broke from drought in 2020. We do know in that restocker market that people buy animals from all over, and especially with the online platform being there, we do know that having a national footprint is more important for that restocker market.
Is it challenging to capture that data from both the online and in-person or live sales?
It's not. We launched the online indicators in November, and we've obviously had the physical data being collected by our LMOs way back to 2002. So we have spent a lot of time. This is not just been created today. There's been a lot of time spent in the back end ensuring that those two data sets can be merged and together they can create one indicator.
And you mentioned too that this is specifically live weight, which is another difference. Why choose to do it in live weight?
The ECHI was created for a possible beef futures market, and that would obviously require the need for it to be in carcass weight. All other indicators are in live weight, and that is really the currency that producers think about when they are transacting cattle. So what we thought is it was important to have a restocker indicator that was presented in a live weight basis that reflects actually how producers transact cattle.
A lot of people will look at the ECHI and look at the number and know it's over $10, that's extraordinary. It's, you know, down around $3, that's problematic. What do you think people will draw from the NICI? What will they, when they see the number, what do you think that'll mean to them?
Well, as it's a fully, truly restock indicator, it's actually going to give producers a really good understanding, and industry stakeholders for that matter, a really good understanding of sentiment in the industry. It's going to be a lead indicator because we saw in 2020 when the rains broke, the restocker element were paying a premium and were the ones sourcing those cattle and the most vigorously. So we knew that sort of preceded the demand from feeders and processors. And similarly, when prices sort of eased last year and there were concerns about the drought, restockers were the first to exit the market. So having a restocker indicator, a restocker-specific indicator, will give industry a really good understanding of the sentiment and the future. It'll be a really good way to gauge the sentiment looking forward for industry.
I guess the comparison then, the ECHI, because it includes the feedlotters and the processors, that's an indicator really of the confidence in some of those parts of the industry to buy. But the restocker really does give us that sense of future confidence of whether or not people are prepared to carry more animals based on what they know is coming down the pipe.
Yes, exactly. So the restocker sentiment will look at if producers are buying heifers to build up their herd numbers, or if they're looking at buying some steers to add some weight to sell into the market, into that sort of feedlot or finished market down the track. So it will give us a really good indicator into what producers on the ground are thinking of doing.
And so how can people find and make use of the NICI?
So the NICI went live this morning at 8:30 this morning. The NICI, as we're calling it, went live on the MLA website, and it can be found under the Prices and Markets page on the website.
That was MLA's Market Information Manager Steve Bignall speaking to Kelly Buchanan on the first day of Beef Australia.
There's a swag of great movies on ABC iView. Bold, beautiful, and uniquely Australian.
Give me a bucket.
There's Mystery Road's Detective Jay Swan in Goldstone.
Things are going to change sooner or later.
Dance, sport, drama in Strictly Ballroom.
I want to dance with you your way.
Tim Winton's novel adapted in Breath. Plus Sisters of War, Looking for Alibrandi, and so many more.
Because that's how life is.
Great Aussie movies. Always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
It's 13 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour. Now, a group representing milk processors is warning Australian farmers that they're being paid much more than the world price for dairy. The Australian Dairy Products Federation has released data that it says shows farmers in Australia are being paid a premium of as much as 30%. Now, as the clock ticks on new season's milk prices, which are announced by June the 1st, CEO of the ADPF, Janine Waller, is warning farmers that price cuts could be coming.
And I think the biggest point is that there's clearly a disconnect between the global commodity prices, so the prices of your powders, your cheese, your butter, and the farm gate milk price that we're seeing here. And that's really what we're trying to help the farmer understand, is what's actually going on and what will that then mean in terms of 1 June and the prices that they may see.
So your argument is that milk is overpriced in Australia right now?
It's more just trying to highlight the facts as to what goes into the milk price in Australia. And at the moment, we're not competitive with what's going on internationally.
So paint that picture. Talk numbers. What are we looking at here? How much more is the industry paying for milk in Australia compared to competitors around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest indicator that we use is a term called the commodity milk value, and I don't want to complicate by terms. So simply it's a forward price indicator. It's a mechanism that we can use that gives us a bit of an indication around milk price. And at the moment, that's sitting at about $7.30 per kilogram of milk solids. Maybe the number not as important as the difference to what we're currently paying for milk at the moment. So it's a 30% less than, or $2 less than what we're paying for our average price of milk in our southern region, which is sitting at about $9.40 per kilo of milk solids. So it's that big difference. You've got a 30%, $2 less differential between that value and the price that we're paying at the moment. In addition to that, though, we look at spot prices. So we look at the prices of what's going on with cheese, milk powders, et cetera, and that's really thinking about where does milk end up. The most significant drop we've seen has been with cheese. So that's down almost 30%. So, again, that's important because the bulk, you could almost say almost sort of 40, 50% of our milk is going into cheese. And when the price of that is dropping at a global level, it obviously means then that there's a consequence because our cost of production is still going up.
So you're saying that dairy farmers should expect a 30% fall in price when it comes to June?
No. Our role as ADPF is really to talk about the landscape. What happens in terms of numbers is really between processors and farmers.
Is it any real surprise that a group representing largely processors would say milk's overpriced?
So we're not saying it's overpriced. You've got to be careful, obviously, with the language that we're using. As you said, compared to what's happening internationally, there's clearly a disconnect. So there's obviously a high cost. But as you said, it's recognising milk is such an important ingredient. So we want to be fair to the farmer, and it's about being fair to the processor because we want everybody to be here for the long term. And really what it's trying to put it into perspective is we are seeing from a processing perspective businesses close. You know, that's the reality that's happened because of the tough market conditions, but that's also a sign of them rationalising so that they can make sure that supply meets their business model and that they're here for the long term as well.
When you talk about the state of play the dairy industry has found itself in is a supply and demand situation, hasn't it? Because of either actions of previous processors, some of which don't exist anymore, the milk pool in Australia shrunk significantly, and to keep factories going, processors had to overpay. So do you worry for the industry, if you're looking at the wider landscape, if the price drops next season, more farmers will simply exit the industry and you'll remain in this difficult spiral that the industry can't get itself out of?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely valid. I mean, as you said, supply demand is part of it, but there's so many other elements that are at play. I think it's about how do we make sure that we are the right size so that we've got the supply that we need, that we can pay a fair price for that, and that we can compete locally and internationally. And it's really about getting that balance right. And ideally, you know, getting the farmer having his product value and the process of obviously being sustainable at the same time.
So how do you do that? Because it's a balancing act, isn't it, for the industry? You can't afford too many more farmers to leave, but you can't afford processors continually losing money.
100%. As you said, it's sort of the business 101. And there's so many factors as to why production has dropped. You know, when you look at it from a farmer perspective, they've had challenges with input costs and labour and competing land uses, whether it's, you know, beef versus dairy. So there's so many factors that are at play that we've got to work through collectively to go, how do we get the right volume of milk that we need at the right time of year for the right price, so that, as you said, you've got the farmer that is here for the long term and you've got the processor that's here for the long term, and we can compete with all of the products on a local perspective and also internationally.
That was the CEO of the Australian Dairy Products Federation, Janine Waller, and she was speaking there to Warwick Long.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, lucerne harvest in the southeast is mostly done and dusted for the season. So how did the region's crops perform? Well, the unexpectedly wet summer has led to around a 30% drop in yields compared to the average over the last few years. Scott Hutchings is a senior agronomist with Delta Ag and Lucerne Australia chair. He says while harvest ran late last year, this year it was early.
A lot of growers locked up moderately early, slightly on the early side than average because of a predicted kind of dry, hot summer. Unfortunately, that didn't eventuate, and we had a very, very wet December and early January and cold conditions right through to February. That's not very favourable for lucerne seed. We like hot, dry conditions so the bees can pollinate and the lucerne can be stressed to trigger it into a reproductive phase. So, yeah, basically we looked at we've had the individual paddocks that have been quite reasonable crops. As a general rule, I'd say harvest would be probably around 30% down on long-term or kind of averages, particularly over the last few years.
And is that across the whole of the southeast, or are there any regions particular?
Yeah, the whole of the southeast was pretty much affected by those same conditions. And like I say, we did have the odd favourable or quite reasonable crop, but they were few and far between. And people's averages were kind of significantly down on what they'd usually grow. What we saw was those early dryland crops actually yielded quite well. But then there was a lot of dry land locked up on the basis of the rainfall through December and mid-January. And that later lock-up dry land lucerne was a mixed bag, but generally, yeah, struggled a little bit to get the higher yields. Yeah, and the irrigation lucernes were kind of some of the earlier crops, and probably the later crops were at the top end of the yields. But we also saw later in the season probably higher seed wasps than we've seen in the last few years as well. Massive. We've had more significant seed loss levels, but they certainly were significantly higher than the last couple of years. That caused probably higher clean outs. We're still waiting for the results and the cleaning sheds to get through, but we certainly saw that. Probably the best is we didn't have a lot of rain through harvest. They had pretty good harvest conditions through most of the harvest period.
Any pest problems over the season?
No, nothing particularly significant other than the later seed wasp. We're still struggling a bit with mirids, Australian crop mirids, which are a pest relatively new to the production system. And we did have a few little outbreaks of aphids in the cool weather, but we seem to have got our management techniques. There's been quite a bit of research on some new chemistry introduced for blue-green aphids to fight resistance within the industry. So, you know, while we had the outbreaks, they were well managed. But, yeah, Australian crop mirid were probably the most persistent pest. And then we had the effect of seed wasps. And we saw low seed wasp levels pretty early in the season, and they climbed throughout the year.
Mm. And so not a great year. Do you think that any of the farmers will be maybe changing up their crops away from lucerne next season, or do you think maybe the, you know, predicted dry conditions later in the year, they'll stick with it?
Yeah, lucerne's a perennial crop, so usually once you're committed for that certification period, and I find with what I do, my irrigated area is very stable year on year out. We might see if prices particularly crash and it's dry conditions, we see a bit of a swing to hay. But we did see a major swing back in 2017-2018 where we dropped from 26,000 hectares with poor prices and poor yields, and then we went back to the next year it dropped to a kind of 11,000 hectares of certified production. So, and we're back up to around about 14,000-15,000 hectares now. So really, year on year, by irrigation levels or the irrigation levels I see through the district stay pretty stable, but the dry land can go from moderate levels in the area to quite significant levels if we have good spring rainfall or early summer rainfall.
That was Lucerne Australia's chair, Scott Hutchings, and he was speaking there to Elsie Adamo.
Conversations.
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
So I'm going to drive this car latitudinally across Australia. There's a single cylinder car, so it would have one piece.
What?
Bang, 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 bang. The next day, they were going to be front page news. That night, this big ship in the North Atlantic hits an iceberg. and the Titanic happens.
Oh, no!
And so they miss out.
Hear the latest conversations.
Weekday mornings from 11 on ABC Radio.
Or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
It's 24 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour. You're with Selena Green today, and it's time to head to the Weather Bureau for the first time this week. And we say hello to our forecaster, Jenny Horvat. Hello, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Selena.
Is it looking like we might get some rains this week?
More across the northeast pastoral district than anywhere else. We've got a bit of a mid-level trough moving through later in the week, but doesn't look promising for the agricultural areas, unfortunately. But we'll have to be a little bit of a wait and see to see how far south that tracks. But the start of the week is looking pretty stable. Still got a strong high pressure system to the south of the state, maintaining that broad sort of southeast easterly airstream across the state for today and tomorrow. A little bit cool in parts this morning without being overly too cold. We did see some of those minimum temperatures getting down to around 2.5 degrees at Keith, around 3 degrees out west at Woodna and Kyane Cutter, Ceduna, about 4.5 degrees this morning. So it was a little bit cool in parts, and again tomorrow morning can expect to see some cooler minimums again. We did see a little bit of fog around as well this morning, especially around the southeast and pushing in across the Murray land. So a little bit of fog patches again, not out of the question across the agricultural area Tuesday morning there as well. Could see a little bit of frost, probably less likely, probably looking at minimum temperatures similar to this morning. But I guess if we get a bit of wind dropping out, we could see a little bit cooler in parts. But yes, dry couple of days to start the week. So for today and tomorrow, and then we'll have this mid-level trough starting to move across from the west. So we could start to see a little bit of shower activity coming across maybe northern parts of Eyre Peninsula, but looks likely to be more likely across the pastoral districts. So on the Wednesday there, probably more likely across the northwest pastoral district and maybe starting to move into the northeast pastoral district. But as we roll on into Thursday, it looks like that trough consolidates a little bit and seeing potentially some heavier falls around, especially the northern parts there of the northeast pastoral district. Could still be a little bit around the Flinders through there on the Thursday. It is going to be a little bit hit and miss with some storm activity on the Wednesday and the Thursday, but again, more likely probably seeing that activity across the northeast pastoral district, especially on the Thursday there. So it is going to be a little bit of a watch this space with the movement of that trough and whether we can pull some of that rainfall a little bit further, especially on the Friday as it all continues to move east. So whether we start to see some activity getting into the Riverlands and the Murraylands, it's going to be a little bit of a watch this space. And then we've also got a bit of a timing issues as it moves across as well, whether some of that will still be lingering on our eastern border districts there on the Saturday. Still a little bit of a chance there, but as we head into Sunday, it should definitely have cleared the state and returning to dry conditions for Sunday and next Monday. So having a bit of a look at some of those temperatures again, we're still expecting to see temperatures today above average, especially in the west and south, and then the northeast maybe a little bit below average. Tomorrow, temperatures again mostly above average, and then looking below average in the northeast under that cloud as we head into the later part of the week, but remaining generally sort of average or above average across the agricultural area. And having a look at some of that rainfall that we can expect until the end of Friday. So again, today and tomorrow are looking at dry conditions, but then only sort of a couple of millimetres at best, maybe across Northern Eyre Peninsula and the West Coast District and some of those southeastern districts. Across the Flinders and North East Pastoral District, based on the current guidance, looking at probably 2 to 5 millimetres, but then locally some falls of 5 to 20 millimetres are possible, especially around that northeast pastoral district. And with some thunderstorm activity, couldn't rule out some local falls of maybe 20 to 50 millimetres or maybe some isolated ones getting even above 50 millimetres as we head into the later part of the week across the northeast pastoral district through there, Selena. So yeah, some rainfall for the state, but not looking likely across the agricultural areas, unfortunately.
We might have to wait a little bit longer. All right, thanks, Jenny.
No worries. Thanks, Selena.
Jenny Horvat there from the Weather Bureau. Now, tomorrow's forecast for the western inland parts of New South Wales. For the upper western district, mostly sunny with east to southeasterly winds, 25 to 35 k's now. Overnight, between 11 and 14 degrees. Daytime temperatures in the low to mid 20s. For the lower western district, sunny, east to southeasterly winds, 20 to 30 k's now. Overnight, between 7 and 10 degrees, with daytime temperatures in the low 20s. It's coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Up next, a delay in the 3G switch off.
You're listening to the Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Oh, hello. Have you heard the news? Well, Telstra is delaying its 3G closure amid concerns that hundreds of thousands of Australians could be blocked from making emergency calls once the 20-year-old network has been switched off. Now, the telco was due to shut down the network on June 30, but it's going to postpone that closure until August 31 to give more people more time to upgrade their handsets. Now, that includes a lot of farmers who use 3G technology for their farming systems and connectivity. In a moment, we'll have a bit of a closer look at the implications of a 3G shutdown on Australian agriculture. Also coming up, have you ever tried eating insects? And I don't mean, you know, accidentally when you're out riding your motorbike or swallowing a fly or when you're running with your mouth open and a few insects eaten that way by accident. I mean consuming insects as a meal. Have you ever tried it? Well, let me know, what was it? How did you rate the taste? My talkback number 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. I ask because in this half an hour, for something a bit different, you'll head to a South Australian winery that's pairing crickets with Cabernet.
We've had some good reactions so far. Some people, disgusted. Other people presently surprised. So it's a mixed bag. So it's interesting.
Would you be willing to have it a go? I'll come back to that. That's after news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hello.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, authorities in Mexico have confirmed the bodies they found in Baja California are those of the three missing tourists from Australia and the US. The parents of Perth brothers Jake and Callum Robinson visited the morgue a short time ago to identify their bodies. Local police have several people in custody and say that a murder investigation is underway. Testing is underway to see if blue-green algae contributed to the deaths of nearly 60 penguins near Victor Harbour this year. The Department for Environment and Water has been asked to investigate, with dozens of birds being found each month. Flinders University penguin researcher Stephen Hedges says starvation does not appear to be the cause, like it has in previous years. And a winery in the Coonawarra is pairing wine with different types of edible insects as part of a push to promote its sustainability credentials. Patrick of Coonawarra is pairing Riesling with ant candy, Shiraz with corn chips made with cricket protein, and cinnamon-flavoured mealworms with Cabernet as part of a tasting plate. Winemaker and owner Luke Tokashu says not all customers have enjoyed the combinations, but they have all learnt more about sustainable winemaking practices. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, Telstra is delaying the shutdown of its 3G network by 2 months. It was originally planned for June 30th. As I said earlier, it will now happen on the 31st of August. And that's partly because there's a large number of people still using the 3G service. Well, David Claughton spoke with Chana Senariza, who is in charge of technology development at Telstra, about the delay.
Even though we announced our closure 5 years ago, and we've been upgrading our network and that's progressing well, we realise that even as of now, we've still got something like 200,000 handsets on the 3G network, which haven't been upgraded yet. And so we wanted to kind of give our customers 2 more months, and we've decided to delay the closure until the 31st of August.
Right. And so I suppose, why do you think people have been slow to change their handsets over?
Look, honestly, I don't know. I mean, in some cases, I think maybe the message hasn't got through. Even though we've been talking about it for 5 years, we've advertised on multiple channels, we've actually contacted them directly. via text message, etc. And partly it may be human nature that people just kind of wait till the last minute. But what we've done in the last few weeks, first in early April, we released a SMS checker. So what you have to do is to text the number 3 to 3498 from your handset, and it will tell you if your handset will work on our network after the 31st of August. That's one measure. And we've had something like 80,000 hits on that, and 90% of people who texted to that number have got compliant devices, but there's still 10% turned up that they were told you need to upgrade. Now, in addition to that, we will release next week, from about the 15th of May, if you have one of those devices that need to be upgraded, when you make a call, you will be played a very short message that says, hey, you need to upgrade your device. It won't work after the 31st of August. And so that's, if you like,
that'll be a clear warning, won't it? And do you think customers have got an adequate options out there in terms of upgrading their device for a reasonable price, particularly when you get into this kind of area of remote and rural service where you do need a pretty good handset?
Yeah, look, we think we have. I mean, we've got a range of devices, and particularly those with the blue tick capability, and we also recognize that there are some customers who don't necessarily want a really expensive smartphone, so we have got a couple of options which are available through our retail channels, which are, if you like, some of the old-fashioned sort of flip phones, and they're sort of retailing, the cheapest of them retails for around $60.
And what about loss of service after this switch from 4G to 5G, because that's been happening already, hasn't it? Telstra's just been going around the country, as have Optus and others, to change the equipment over to 4 and 5G, but some people are experiencing loss of service. So what's happening there?
So if they are, when we do the upgrade, we advise the community that there will be a temporary shutdown of the site while we do the upgrade. When we finish the upgrade, we bring back, obviously, whatever the new capabilities, whether it's 4G or 5G, but we absolutely bring back 3G. So we have said very clearly, we will not shut down the 3G network until we have demonstrated to ourselves that we have got 4G equivalent coverage wherever there's 3G. So the loss of service, it should only be temporary while the upgrades are continuing.
And how, in terms of that progressive work, have you been around to every tower now in the country, or is there still a fair few to go?
We have, at this point in time, just over 100 towers left to upgrade. And like we've always said, that from a network perspective, we would have all our network upgraded to 4G, where we have 3G only, by the 30th of June, and we're on track to complete that.
There will be some people who, by good luck really, rather than proper coverage planning, get a 3G service at the moment, but they may not be on the coverage map for 3G, which is really, that's your promise, isn't it? You will make sure that there's 4G coverage wherever there's, people are on the map. But there are a number of people that are not on the map that are getting 3G currently, have invested quite a lot of money into using that service and getting the equipment they need to run it. What will happen to those people?
So, what we've clearly said is that we will provide 4G equivalent coverage in accordance with the published map. And so if there are people who are getting coverage outside of that area, there is obviously the chance that they will lose that coverage. If people are using 3G beyond it, that's called fortuitous coverage.
So they'll drop off, you think?
Yeah, they will drop off. I mean, in some cases, they may not, David. I mean, because the spectrum, so this is all dictated by the laws of physics, in terms of the propagation that. So if people are getting this fortuitous coverage, it's because the 3G coverage is propagating beyond the published coverage map, and you're getting a whiff of coverage somewhere. Now that's at what we call the low band, so that's at 850 meg. Now 4G is a bit low, actually, so at 700 meg. So there is a possibility you will get the same, little bit of fortuitous coverage from 4G as well.
And some people are experiencing a change to their 3G coverage when 4G towers go up or the new equipment's put up. And they're, and sometimes it's like at the, when they're at the bottom of the hill and the 4G signal's now booming across the range to reach some population, you know, hotspot. They're in the Fresnel zone, we've heard people refer to. What can those people do if they suddenly can't get access to the 3G anymore, they can't get the 4G because they're in this funny pocket?
Well, if there are people who have had experienced a loss of service as a result of any upgrade, we are encouraging people to contact us. We have an engineering team who are ready to investigate any anomalies, and we work with various, the National Farmers Federation, Isolated Children's Organisations, where we've been telling them the same story, that, you know, if any of their stakeholders experience any problems, then they have to contact, you know, please contact us. We've got people in regional Australia, the regional general managers, and they've got advertised numbers. We want to hear from them. We want to hear as soon as possible, and particularly with the extension of 2 months, we would encourage them to contact us so that we can investigate.
That's Chana Senezeratna from Telstra there. So you text the number 3 to 3498 from your handset. Apparently that will tell you then if your handset will work in the new network. Customers will get warning messages, we're told, from the 15th of May if your devices need updating. Hello to Sam on the text line. Sam's in the southeast. Sam's text says, the local 4G network is nowhere near good enough to switch fully. There are plenty of places where there is no 4G reception, but 3G coverage is exceptional, says Sam. Well, many of you may have already changed the settings on your phone or bought a new one, but a lot of farmers are facing a much bigger challenge when Telstra and Optus shut down the 3G network. 3G is used on farms to remotely monitor pumps, run security cameras, open gates, turn things on and off, check tanks, or get readings from soil moisture probes and weather stations. David Claughton reports on some of the problems that farmers are having with the shutdown and some solutions for staying connected.
June 30 is the day Telstra will switch off its 3G towers and Optus will complete the shutdown in September. But farmers are already having problems as mobile phone towers around the country are decommissioned or changed over to 4 and 5G.
Everything's based on being connected. You've got to have a signal going back to this. You're trying to do, you know, traceability with your farm records and everything else. And you're just sort of taking for granted that this is working or that's working, it's connected, it's on the internet. That once the 3G network is actually shut down, we're going to start going, hang on a minute, that was working last week and now it's not.
That's Chair of the New South Wales Farmers Association Dubbo branch, Tracy Blackburn. She's warning farmers to have a look at their hardware to make sure it's got 4G and 5G capacity. Grain grower Ian Carter has successfully upgraded 4 of his tractors, but other equipment on his farm at Corindi in New South Wales stopped working after the mobile towers in his area were updated. Getting his equipment connected again has been difficult.
It's very frustrating at the moment. We've all gone and bought boosters for houses and buildings and vehicles and things like that to try and make it work better, but you know, we shouldn't be doing that. Boosters are $1,000 a go or so, you know, and machines are something like that or a bit more as well. And just, yeah, there is a cost to it. But hopefully, like Telstra tell us, that it will improve once they do actually switch it off and the 4G and 5G takes over. So let's hope that's right. I know things are a lot different now with automatic weather stations or security cameras or trough sensors or all that sort of stuff. So, you know, that's the big difference and that's where we're heading.
Phil Epthorpe runs a company called NB Tech. They have hundreds of clients, including some big corporate farms, who've also had problems.
We recently engaged with a big property, irrigation property, out in Western New South Wales. All of their irrigation equipment was implemented years ago and only could connect using 3G. In their case, the process of upgrading the network towers around their area, which involves removing the 3G and enhancing 4G and adding 5G, means that suddenly all of their irrigation equipment could not be operational.
What were they running off 3G? What stopped working?
Oh, in their case, it was irrigation and also their mobile phones. They were broadacre cotton farmers, so they couldn't water the cotton crops.
It took a special team to fix that problem, but Epthorpe says Telstra is willing to work with landholders to make sure the new 4 and 5G services have the same coverage as the old 3G, up to a point. It has to align with 3G coverage maps, and that would leave some people getting service beyond the maps out in the cold. Here's Chris Taylor, Telstra's General Manager for the Southern New South Wales region.
What we would expect is that once we've completed all of the optimisation work, that our customers should be able to get 4G coverage in the same place as they can get 3G. What we mean by that is that where you can make a handheld phone call on the 3G network, outdoors, and our coverage maps show that you can do that, you'll be able to do that on the 4G network, and that's our aim before we close the 3G network.
So the promise was same or better coverage, yeah?
The same or better coverage, that's right.
Tech companies are reporting good data transmission from 4 and 5G towers with a range up to 80 kilometres. Here's Phil Epthorpe again.
We've got clients extending out to about 80 kilometres and still getting very usable 4G services.
So 80 kilometres from a tower?
Yeah. In the case of 5G, it's much more critical in terms of the terrain associated with a particular point-to-point connection. But we've got clients extending out to about 15 kilometres and still being able to get in the vicinity of 250 up to 550 megabits per second downlink and 40 to 65 megabits per second uplink.
But what if you can't get a mobile signal? Or you've got a good internet service at the homestead using mobile reception or satellites and you want to extend that across your property. FarmBot is an Australian company delivering remote monitoring equipment here and in the United States and Canada. Chief Executive Andrew Coppen said there's a range of solutions that could help and some of it connects your equipment in the field directly with satellites.
The roadmap of things that are evolving here with new telecommunications investment both from 4G and NB-IoT and satellite innovation is going to allow us to do an ever-increasing range of things to be able to turn things on and off, to open and close things, to monitor things in remote areas at very, very low cost relative to the benefit that it will get by knowing what is happening in the backfield.
FarmBot are using, among other things, low-power, wide-area cellular technology, also called Cat-M1, which can give you internet connectivity in remote areas, but it won't carry a lot of data. Brian Thompson is a tech expert and owner of Porosity, which supports clients in the cotton and wine industry. They've got about 120 people they're working with to make the changeover, and it's costing those clients between $1,000 to $10,000 to make the upgrade. They're also using Cat-M1 to help clients outside mobile coverage areas.
The newer telemetry systems that we're going to be using are on the LTE-M network, so that covers Cat-M1 and NB-IoT. They're very technical terms.
But they are very technical terms. Range. What does that mean?
They've actually got bigger range than 3G. We've encountered one single location north of the Queensland border where we couldn't get Cat-M1 signal strength. But everywhere else we've had a monitoring device, we've had better signal strength on Cat-M1 than we've had on 3G.
Right, so you think this is probably a good news story, the shutdown of the 3G network. You think ultimately farmers and people in rural areas will actually be better off?
Oh, look, I think there's an opportunity here. Yeah, of course, there's a bit of a headache, in fact, in terms of having to switch over old gear that's working perfectly fine for newer gear. You know, the old saying of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But, you know, the newer networks, in my opinion, are better than the 3G network. I think it's an option to upgrade and get good data collection. We can ensure that continuity of data now going into the next decade, at least, with the transition over to these new 4G, 5G, Cat-M1, LTE-M networks.
Phil Epthorpe is cautious about how much data can travel on some of these systems and how far you can extend Wi-Fi from the house. But despite those limitations, technology is improving all the time. And Phil Epthorpe is excited about research his company's involved with to extend the range even further with antennas.
A couple of our units that we're working with are world leaders in antenna technologies. And a lot of this has to do with developing new revolutionary antenna technology.
Sadly, you can't wait for the next generation of farm tech to hit the market because Telstra's 3G network will be switched off on June 30.
Well, in fact, it's going to be the 31st of August due to that delay announced today. So August 31 for Telstra 3D shutdown. That is a report filed by David Claughton with extra reporting from Lara Webster and Michael Condon. And you can read more about that on our ABC News website. A few texts coming through on this one. Gail on the text line says, this guy ever tried to contact Telstra? A joke, says Gail. This text, no name, but it says, I've got a 5G phone, but the other day I noticed it was using the 3G network. The company must have done that. My question is, why would it be dropped from 5 to 3? What will happen at these times in the future? And Ryan's at Gulfview Heights. Ryan said, on a recent drive to Melbourne, the phone signal dropped to 3G in quite a few places, and that was on the main road between Adelaide and Melbourne. Ryan, same. I did a drive to Melbourne on the weekend going through Western Victoria Ballarat way. And I noticed that quite a few times my signal dropped back. There's quite a few areas that was on the 3G network on that on those pretty major roads as well.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
So if you like a drop of wine, what's your favourite food to pair with your wine? Maybe a pasta with a Pinot Noir or blue cheese and a Riesling. How about Cabernet and crickets? It's a combo. A winery in the southeast is hoping consumers may be willing to give a go. And reporter Elsie Adamo went along to hear and taste what it was all about.
I've been to the occasional wine tasting over the years, but never one quite like this. What I'm about to try at Patrick of Coonawarra in the South Australian southeast is a completely new kind of experience.
And am I meant to chew on it or am I meant to... All right.
What I am about to try is a rock candy, but instead of the usual flavouring, tyrant ants have been used as the key ingredient, paired with a Riesling wine.
Mmm. Tastes like candy.
Yeah. This was actually a tyrant ant, which is like a bit of a sugar ant. So they don't have that real anty flavour that you would associate with the normal ants, so they're not too bad.
They actually do kind of go together quite well. Not that that should be a surprise, but...
The candy is part of a crickets and cabernet tasting journey, which the winery has recently launched. The idea came from Patrick of Coonawarra owner and winemaker Luke Tokashu.
For the Panola and Coonawarra Arts Festival, I really wanted to do something outside the box, and I've always wanted to do an edible insect kind of wine pairing to just get people thinking about, you know, future and edible insects. But it also ties in really well with a few projects we've got going on in Celador. So the whole idea around it is to promote our eco garden that we've just built at Celador. And that's promoting beneficial insects coming into the vineyard and part of our Sustainable Wine Growing Australia accreditation that we've just received. So really the focus is on what we're doing in the vineyard, and it's a novel way to sort of bring that vineyard experience into Celador with a bit of a novelty and something different.
The tasting includes four different courses: ant candy, cricket corn chips, dried cinnamon mealworms, and roasted chilli and garlic crickets, each paired with a wine to complement their flavour.
Some people are really open and happy to try them. You know, they've had that experience overseas, maybe eating insects and things. Other people flat out refuse to taste them. So we've had a mixed bag here in Celador so far. We tried some with some customers the other day, and they're all a bit hesitant at the start, but I think working their way up from the chips to the crickets at the end, they all had a taste and were pleasantly surprised. Not that bad.
So are you expecting much interest? Do you think lots of people will be coming by to try it out?
Yeah, we have. We've had a lot of interest so far. People calling and saying, is this really? Is you really eating crickets? And we have to say, yeah, come and do it and come and challenge yourself. So I think over the arts festival, when we're launching, everybody will come in, and there'll be a lot of people challenging their friends to try it, or who's going to do it first and that sort of thing. So it'll be a bit of interest, and I plan to have
a wall of photos of people's reactions when they taste them. So that'll be a fun little project for us to do.
So you're expecting most people pull a bit of a face sometimes when they're trying?
Well, yeah, we've had some good reactions so far. Some people, disgusted. Other people presently surprised. So it's a mixed bag. So it's interesting.
So how do you even go about pairing wine and insects? Owner of Circle Harvest, Skye Blackburn, is an insect protein farmer and is supplying the food for the tasting. While she has had many different requests over the years, helping to pair wine and crickets was something new.
So we were approached and to say that they were doing their amazing event where they're pairing different kinds of edible insects with, you know, their delicious wines. And it's absolutely fantastic. We haven't done anything similar before. So I think it's something very, very new and exciting. And when Lynn asked us to pair some of our Australian farmed insect kind of flavours with their wines, she sent me over some tasting notes. So hopefully I've done a good job because I don't drink a lot of wine. But my brother actually is a viticulturist. So hopefully we've done a good job pairing the wines with the different kinds of bugs and people will get a completely new experience, which is fantastic.
Are you hoping that this will kind of show off edible insects in a different way?
Yeah, well, I have always thought that edible insects are a very gourmet kind of food. They're very nutrient dense and they're very sustainable. So I feel like this is a fantastic opportunity to help educate people about edible insects, to help realise that, you know, edible insects can be completely normal. It can be in completely normal food and you wouldn't even know that it's there, which is kind of amazing as well. And getting out and trying new experiences, like this is a completely new experience for everybody involved. So I feel like that's a really, really good opportunity to learn something new, to taste something new and have this really fantastic experience that you can go out and tell your friends about as well.
So for those that haven't eaten insects before, do you have any advice for them or some pointers on what they might expect from the taste?
Oh, well, different insects have completely different tastes, which is fantastic, and you can include them in lots of different things as well. So if you have something like a cricket has a really mild kind of almondy flavour if you try it by itself, but it kind of has the characteristics of tofu where it absorbs the flavours that are around it, so it means that it's really, really versatile. You can add it to things like pasta or even brownies, and it kind of increases the nutrition in there without adding a lot of flavour. Then we have something like tyrant ants, which we farm for a lot of the world's top restaurants. And Australian tyrant ants have this really cool citrus flavour to them, but it's not like a citrus that you've had before. So it's not specifically like lemon or lime or orange, but you would say that it's citrus. So it really just depends, you know, where the insects have come from and what they're fed and, you know, what kinds of insects they are to what kind of flavour profiles you're going to get there.
So you've been doing this for a number of years now, Skye. Has the business just continued to grow, and do you think there is more interest in eating insects each year as time goes on?
Yeah, definitely. So we've been farming insects for over 17 years now, so quite a long time. And we have seen a huge shift in people's focus when it comes to food. So now people want more nutrient-dense kind of foods, local, sustainable foods, and edible insects really do tick all the boxes. You don't have to be eating like a huge scorpion or a tarantula to be enjoying the benefits of insects. It can be in like a pasta or even like cricket protein corn chips, which is our biggest seller. So each bag of the corn chips will have as much protein as an egg in there. It's got heaps of vitamin B12 and iron, all your amino acids for the day as well. So instead of having, you know, your normal bag of corn chips, which really doesn't do a lot for your body, it's not very nutrient dense, you can kind of swap that for something that's very nutrient dense, and that's what people want. People are moving more towards a flexitarian diet here in Australia. They're eating a bit less meat, they're looking for alternative proteins, and they want a more sustainable diet.
That is Circle Harvest owner Skye Blackburn speaking with Elsie Adabo. Well, now I can't get the thought of eating a tarantula out of my head. If you want to see any photos of the tasting, you can head online to abc.net.au/rural and read Elsie's story right now and see the photo she took. good on her for taking one for the team. I don't know. I would have a go, but I don't know. This text says, went to a cricket farm in Vietnam. They made us cold rolls filled with them. Was not too bad. Need sauce or something to go with it to make it tasty, says this texter, but I would not recommend it on an empty stomach. Coming to you for afternoons, Nikolai Bailharts. Hello.
Yeah, I've had eaten crickets before.
Yeah?
They're fine. They're all right.
All right.
They're fine.
Yeah, fine.
They're
yeah.
crunchy.
Try anything once.
Yeah.
With enough seasoning.
Yeah, seasoning helps, and ants as well, I think, was the other thing that I had. But, you know, if the arguments that I've seen have been, you know, hey, this might be a sustainable way to eat protein into the future, yeah. maybe we're going to have to get used to it.
Exactly. Mm. What have you got for us today?
What's your handwriting like?
Messy. Like a,
yeah.
like a, I was about to say a doctor, but then that's probably offensive to doctors. Apologies to doctors, but anyone knows.
yeah, mine's not great either. I tend to write in all capitals just because I'm hoping that it'll make it a little easier for other people to read if need be. But we're going to take a look at that this afternoon about whether the role of handwriting has become redundant in the day of computers.
Yeah, and still people need to get their pen license.
Exactly.
Good question. Nikolai, we'll be with you this afternoon. Thanks for your company. News time.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.